This podcast is brought to you by Fresh FM, with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Greetings and many thanks for joining me for today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood, the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Today's episode is an interview with John Lang. We cover everything from shipping bunker fuel to UK politics. It's a full interview, so let's get on with it. Today's guest is a mover and shaker in the climate scene. John Lang is a Kiwi currently based in the UK. He's a barrister, a climate consultant, and a graphic artist. He's also a co-founder of Net Zero Tracker, founder of the global organization Kiwis in Climate, and has recently launched Climate Trunk, an exciting online climate education initiative, which we'll hear more about very soon. A big welcome to Climate Matters, John. It's lovely to have you on the Front Footing the Future interview series.
Kia ora, Lindsay. Thanks for having me. Exciting.
I just want to start, John, with reference to something you said in your chapter in the recently launched, and I have to say very impressive, Kiwis in Climate book. And you say, and I'm quoting from your chapter, "I became a prisoner of what I knew." I think that's a compelling statement, and I'd love it if you'd give us an insight into what you were referring to there.
So I finished university. I was down at Otago, and I went travelling for 3 or 4 years, working on farms to pay my way around. I decided, because I had a very good friend and also a family member who were contrarians when it came to climate change, and I was determined to find out why they were. So I started reading. Did my due diligence in climate change, but not just climate science, also political psychology. So I fell down numerous rabbit holes, obviously climate science. I read The Weathermakers by Tim Flannery, for example, Merchants of Doubt by Naomi Oreskes, which is about the fossil fuel industry using kind of tobacco tactics to muddy the waters of public debate and narrative. And also a book called The Righteous Mind, by Jonathan Haidt, Why Good People Are Divided Over Politics and Religion. And that latter book actually taught me a lot about why people disagree intuitively without having actually looked at the facts. And it taught me a lot about people's opinions on climate change being driven much more from ideology and identity rather than from information. That's why I became a prisoner of what I knew. I just read too much about the issue. And then I was drawn to it, not because I'm an environmentalist. I was drawn to it because I was like, this is the biggest problem in the world. We'll probably talk about Catherine Hayhoe down the line a little bit, but she talks about it as being a threat multiplier. And so it just whacked me around the head. I was like, wow, no one's talking about this. I'm just trying to think what year this was. It was probably around 2013, 2014. I ended up doing my master's at University College London in international environmental law and policy about 3 years after that. And then from there, got a job with the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit. So that was my journey.
Thank you for that. That's interesting. I do want to get straight on to your initiative, Climate Trunk. It sounds terrific. I love the idea of what you're doing. I know your graphics so well. They're really signature graphics. And so please just give us an outline of what Climate Trunk is, how it's unfolding, and who might most benefit from engaging with it.
So about 9 years ago, I read a line in a blog by a chap called Tim Urban. He said, "To grow a tree of knowledge about any issue, you need a strong trunk." I was like, that is an amazing metaphor for climate change, because climate is so multifaceted. It touches politics. We just mentioned psychology or political psychology. You've obviously got the science. You've got the solutions, the technology. You've got the economics, and you've got the political economy. You know, you've got the battles. So I thought, wouldn't it be brilliant to create a portal that built a strong trunk for folks who were time poor but curious about this issue? And as you mentioned, yes, I do graphics. I've learned that on the fly over the last. I basically discovered how powerful a communication device that is. Fast forward 9 years. I need to do this project right now. Otherwise, I won't be able to. I won't have time to do it if kids come along. So that was the kind of spur that got me going. Yes, I launched in April on April 22nd on Earth Day. I originally wanted to do 52 infographics, so one visual a week for a year, but that's very quickly stretched to 128 in a little over 2 years, and I think it's just stretched to 150 because I'm going to add a nature ring. So I'll run you through the rings very quickly, and then I can talk a little bit about the audience.
Please, listeners, visualize that John's talking about a cross section through the trunk of a tree.
Yeah, I think that's really important. The metaphor works in two ways. So yes, it's a cross section of a tree trunk, and the rings flowing out from the core of that tree trunk are science, impacts, economics, political economy, governance, solutions, energy, and life. And by life, I mean you, agency, and your spheres of influence. So I've got eight rings. I'm probably going to add another ring on the year anniversary of the launch. So nature. There is also a good argument to add health. Some people have even suggested I add culture. It also works like a storage trunk. So I want people to come back to Climate Trunk as a repository for high-level information about both the transition and climate change. Who's it for? It's like I mentioned, it's for time-poor people. So I've just piloted this with 28 UK secondary schools. I would like this to be used in schools and universities. I've partnered with Oxford University. I also want to get to parliamentarians and politicians. Would like it to become the world's clearest visual guide to climate and energy. And would love to get it into the New Zealand secondary school system and also universities.
Brilliant, John. I want to give you a bit of an open topic because you're an expert and I don't want to be telling you what to say all the time. What is at the front of your mind in the climate policy space?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I suppose these two ways of looking at this, you know, at the global level and at the national level. Now, I wonder if climate policy also encompasses institutions. So,
yes, good point.
I would probably say it does, yes. So for me, by far the most important thing is the institutional hardware or institutional infrastructure that exists in a country. So we know that the UK implemented the 2008 Climate Change Act, and that brought in carbon budgets and an independent body that scrutinises government plans and emission budgets. So for me, those legal metronomes that are implemented through climate framework laws, like the Climate Change Act in the UK or the Zero Carbon Act in New Zealand, for me, they are the most important because they traverse and straddle different governments. Of course, politics is, there are competing priorities for any politician, and climate can often get pushed under the rug. You know, let's look at the cost of living crisis, for example. You know, net zero had its apotheosis in 2020, 2021, and then it's kind of slightly faded into the background in the public narrative. The reason we need institutional infrastructure, like a Climate Change Act or a Zero Carbon Act, is to ensure that there is a time beat, a responsibility for the sitting government to actually look 12 years in advance and think about a carbon budget. It allows long-term thinking. So for me, that's by far the most important one. Now, at the global level, I'd probably say carbon pricing. Like, how are we going to build a carbon removals industry the size of the global car industry by the second half of the century? It's going to be very hard to do that without a universal price on carbon. In the New Zealand context, I'd probably say we have a real issue around transport, and it's been a really stubborn growth sector in terms of emissions. So I'd probably say scaling solar and batteries, as well as a massive push towards 100% EVs, you know, similar to what Norway has done. So that would be, you know, because we know that solar and batteries is the killer app of the transition, I'd almost add EVs in on that. So how do we create a policy environment to incentivize the mass scale up of solar and batteries and also EVs, and also giving individuals the autonomy to save money?
I noticed you emphasized the incentivize rather than the penalize fossil fuel vehicles. Is that a deliberate juxtaposition?
I work for the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit. We are advocates for evidence. We're analysts, but we're also always wary of political backlash. We try to win the conversation on the right side of the aisle. We're much more interested in the right side of the aisle or the sensible centre than the left. The conversation doesn't need to be won there. To penalise folks for using internal combustion engines, I think you have to be very, very careful because that creates political backlash and that slows down actual progress, the actual transition. We know that markets are moving in one direction anyway. EVs are taking over the world slowly as internal combustion engines are already dead. New Zealand's just so far behind and it's sad. I'd be very careful. One of the most important things is preventing political backlash or at least managing it before you actually implement policy.
Really good perspective, thank you. I want to jump on to zero emissions now or net zero emissions because that's an area that you've gone into quite a lot. Can you unpick the idea of net zero for us and outline both its main strengths and its weaknesses from a policy perspective?
So, yeah, net zero is my bread and butter. Net zero is not a political slogan. It's simple physics and chemistry, and it's the only way to stabilise rising temperatures. So it's as simple as that. And we should repeat that ad nauseum. Net zero is, very simply, the solution to climate change and to stabilising rising. In terms of the concept, there are three elements to it. So by far the most important is reducing emissions. So I use the bathtub in a visual on climate trunk to explain this. And by far the most important thing is to turn down the tap of emissions into the bathtub. That is 80% of the solution.
And the bathtub there is a metaphor for...
Yeah, so it's of the atmosphere. At its heart, net zero, yes, is about reducing emissions and turning the tap down. But as we move through the century, it's also going to be about removing CO2 that is already in the atmosphere. And that's the drain. So that's the drain that isn't working at the moment at scale. There's a little bit coming out of it, mainly going into trees. But we need to scale that up massively by 2050, latest 2070, to be removing billions of tons of CO2 from the atmosphere and storing it geologically underground. Third part of it is equally as important, and that is protecting and maintaining those sinks that are already hoovering up the CO2 from the atmosphere, and that includes both the land and the ocean. The land and the ocean do about equal parts, and they remove about 56% of the CO2 we put into the atmosphere every year. That's, those sinks are weakening as global heating gets worse.
Very good indeed, thank you. You were talking, I think, about carbon capture and storage in terms of sucking out the carbon dioxide. I didn't hear you saying we can do it all with trees. CCS hasn't got the best of presses in the area of success and scalability. Can you comment on that? Because you mentioned Oxford's engaged in it.
So the father of net zero is a guy called Miles Allen. He wrote the initial paper in 2008 alongside Dave Frame, a New Zealander. He talks about the importance of reduce, restore, and remove. So I think it's really important and that we differentiate CCS from carbon removals. So what I was just discussing before was carbon removals from the atmosphere. So that's CO2 that's already in the atmosphere. Carbon capture and storage is not removing CO2 that's in the atmosphere. It's removing it before it hits the atmosphere.
Like at the power stations and things.
Exactly. Power stations and industrial plants. They are very different. Yes, they use similar technology, but they are very different when it comes to the calculations in the atmosphere. So Miles Allen thinks that we need to scale up CCS more. So CCS should be doing more of the hard work than removals up to about 2050. But then removals takes over because hopefully by that point, clean energy has displaced enough fossil fuel, thermal energy, thermal electricity. This comes with massive problems. So you've got the moral hazard of allowing fossil fuel companies to continue operating for longer if they put a CCS application in their plant. And we know that CCS has basically been doing the opposite of solar. So solar's got this exponential curve going up the S curve. CCS is stubbornly at the bottom, and it's not hitting that growth pathway. It's hard. In theory, we should be using CCS. In practice, it's not happening, and the costs are eye-watering. I have an acquaintance, Dimitri Zingalas. He's a professor of economics, he starts all of his talks with, okay, raise your hands. Do you think we will achieve net zero? And, you know, some hands start to hover. Not many hands actually end up going up. And he's like, well, we have to hit net zero. Like, it is non-negotiable. Yeah. And so, but of course, it's been weaponized politically, Lindsay. And, you know, it has a strength in terms of it's got a clear destination. It's also got lots of weaknesses. There's a lot of confusion around what it means. Some people think you can offset your way to net zero. Of course you can't. You know, the most important thing around actually getting to net zero is your near-term emission targets.
You talk well to it. Thanks, John. And I'd like to roll on now to Net Zero Tracker. And then there's another quite well-known platform called Climate Action Tracker. Can you outline for listeners and for me, to be truthful, what insights the two different platforms offer and how New Zealand Inc. is stacking up on them?
I co-founded Net Zero Tracker with my former boss, Richard Black, who was a former BBC environment correspondent. We had a political objective. We wanted to show Theresa May, who was thinking about enshrining net zero by 2050 into law, that the UK wasn't going it alone on net zero. And it then snowballed into a platform that's looked at all nations, all cities with over 500,000 people, all regions in the 25 largest emitting nations in the world, and the 2,000 largest companies in the world. We have a small army of Oxford University students and other volunteers all around the world. So us at the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit, the University of Oxford, an organisation in Germany called New Climate Institute, and the Data Driven Enviro Lab in the US. So what we do is we look at the intent and integrity of net zero targets and strategies. We don't look at implementation measures. That's a net zero tracker. Our bread and butter is integrity. Things like does a company have a plan? Do they have interim targets? Do they report annually? Do they cover all emissions? So Climate Action Tracker does something different. So they look at 42 of the biggest countries in the world, and they look at implementation. They ask, what are these countries? Yes, do they have plans? Do they have a net zero target? What are they doing about it? So what are their policies on transport? What are their policies on industry? And so both are really useful. What do they say about New Zealand? So on the Net Zero Tracker, it shows that we do relatively well on ambition. So on paper, we look good, but on delivery, which we don't look at, we know that's a different story. And Climate Action Tracker are much more scathing about what New Zealand is up to when it comes to climate policy. Make it look like you're doing something, but when you're doing nothing. And that's unfortunately where we're at in New Zealand. And it's shameful. It's hard to scrutinise if you're the lay public. And so they've probably done enough. The current New Zealand government have probably done enough to confuse enough people. So there isn't the outcry that there should be.
It's actually building on what we've just been talking about. What do you see as the key policy tools in the climate crisis toolbox for getting our emissions down permanently to where they need to be for a livable long-term future?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I mean, electricity is only 20% of energy. Today, we need to take that percentage up to 70%. If we electrify the global economy, we will use less primary energy. IRENA, the International Renewables Energy Association, thinks we need to be investing $1 trillion a year over the next 10 years into grids. We need to also, of course, concentrate on those harder to abate sectors. Frankly, this takes investment. So, you know, I'm talking about green steel, green cement, electrolyzers dropping in cost to the point where they can actually decarbonize industry and create feedstocks, for example, for global shipping. So global shipping uses 300 million tons of oil a year. We need to move away from oil to those ships being powered either by methanol or ammonia. And of course, ammonia is a derivative of green hydrogen. So, and the other aspect of this is, and I've mentioned this as well, is scaling up removals. So carbon removals, you know, how does it become a sector as big as the global car industry by the second half of the century? We're just not seeing enough happening there.
Something that you didn't mention, I don't know whether it was deliberate, is the idea of actually doing less. For example, EVs, but not sustaining the fleet at the level it is now, or reducing some of our material throughput. And in fact, you've probably come across Simon Michaud as well, who throws very serious doubts about our capacity globally to sustain the mineral supply that we need for all the scaling up that you were talking about. Where does all that sit on your radar, John?
Yeah, sure. So this is a shifting conversation, and it kind of gets to the heart of it. So we're not going to solve climate change the decisions of 8 billion people. We're going to solve it through changing the minds of about 2,000 decision makers. We're not going to solve climate change through sacrifice. We're going to solve it through substitution. On the minerals question, and I will do a graphic on this. Now we know there are issues, the human rights issues, for example, in Democratic Republic of Congo. You've got bottlenecks of copper in Chile. You've got rare earth minerals in China. The forgotten fact is that we remove so much material from the subterranean earth, and that material is fossil fuels. So if we, and I think by one measurement, the amount of material, minerals we need is about 1/500th to power the energy transition in perpetuity, compared with the amount of fossil fuels we remove from the earth. That 40% of global shipping carries fossil fuels. These unhelpful narratives around mining, they take hold in places like the UK, and it's just a delay tactic. But we're human beings, and there's no natural selection. We have our human nature. We are insatiable animals. I think it's fantasy to think that we are going to start flying less or eating less meat. If you're a politician and you're trying to sell sacrifice, there's going to be another politician who's going to be trying to sell substitution or abundance. Which politician's going to win?
I take your point, John. I wasn't purely meaning sacrifice. For example, Simon Michaud is saying, well, we just logistically can't sustain even the first generation of renewable electricity infrastructure, let alone keep replicating it every 25 years or so.
He's reading different stuff than I am.
What do you think are the main obstacles to adopting the sort of transformative policies?
Climate change at its heart is a global coordination problem. And climate policy often loses because the costs necessary are immediate and concentrated, while the benefits are gradual and distributed. So I think that's the important starting point. Like, this is the perfect problem, as Daniel Kahneman mentioned. He was a Nobel Prize winner in economics. He was a psychologist. He calls this the perfect problem because it's because you could not invent a problem with a worse underlying fit with our psychology. You've got to figure 89% of people in the world think the government should be doing more on climate change. But that's not at the surface. My hope is that there is a groundswell of support similar to 2019, 2020, probably not achieving the heights of that, to put climate back on the map.
Thank you, John. The New Zealand Zero Carbon Act is modelled on the UK precedent, but the UK one seems to be working a lot more effectively than the New Zealand one.
The calibre of the conversation on climate here is much higher than in New Zealand. Politicians get it. It's not as much of a cultural touchpoint as it is in New Zealand. The calibre of the conversation here is just much more advanced than in New Zealand, unfortunately.
One of the things that I've been interested that's crossed my desk a few times lately, John, is the fact that New Zealand, and I think a lot of the Westminster systems, the policy tables do not generally have good representation from scientific, engineering, technical communities. And I've heard from three or four different quarters how prevalent they are in Asian countries. What's your view of the state of good technical nous and climate nous around the policy tables?
Engineers build the future, so they should be at the table. Experts. We don't want to get bogged down in technocrats, but we need people in the room who know how to build. Yeah, and you can see that with rewiring Aotearoa.
Good answer. Thanks, John. I do want you to be able to give a bit of a plug for the Kiwis in Climate book.
So Tessa Vincent orchestrated this whole thing. So I founded Kiwis and Climate back in 2019. It grew organically and very slowly. And MIQ and wrote a letter on behalf of Kiwis and Climate to New Zealand Rugby.
I remember I was involved in that with you.
Indeed. And you know, they had Talkback Radio around their sponsorship deal with INEOS. And so that kind of put Kiwis and Climate on the map in New Zealand. But Tessa Vincent came to me and said, oh, we should do a book. And I was a bit skeptical, but she pulled it off. And it was amazing. So she brought together 28 authors to write about their work, about their climate work. One of the big things for me was to show the diversity of disciplines in this area. You know, climate change is not an environmental issue. It's an economic and social issue. The planet's going to be fine. And I think that it's really important to remind folks that this isn't a left or right issue. And that, for me, that was the big thing about the book, appealing cross-party. You know, we had amazing authors, inspiring to come back to New Zealand and speak with a bunch of them. So it was an absolute inspiration. And I think the main message around this issue being non-partisan, I think landed, and that was, for me, the most important aspect of it all.
Well done. That's the most important message. John, we're just about out of time. Is there anything that's burning a hole in your brain that you'd really like to say to listeners?
I mean, just that I am optimistic about the future. I think, I mean, the two questions that I always get asked, the first one is, are we screwed? And I say, no, we're not. The second one is, what can I do about it? And I always say, we'll talk about it. It's the most important thing. Now, the prerequisite of talking about something is understanding it. And I suppose that's the main motivation behind Climate Trunk. Small plug for Climate Trunk. I'd love folks to subscribe. Third one is there hope? There's a lot of hope. Like, you know, we get to live through the biggest industrial revolution in history. And so for me, that fills me with excitement.
That's actually a great note to finish on, John. Hey, thank you so much. Thank you for everything you do and all your initiatives too.
Oh, good. Thanks, Lindsay. Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure.
For me too. Well, isn't John Lang impressive just how much information he has right at his fingertips? Another impressive guest. We would, however, like a chance to unpick further the issues of reducing the scale of the human enterprise and of the logistics of our mineral supply, both of which are foundational issues but were left hanging in this conversation. Next up, we have a very different scene. We have four members from the wonderful Lighthouse Aotearoa Youth Group, together with their founder and convener, Dr. Will Stovall. The week after that is my good friend and passionate champion of the heavy truck sector, Dave McCoyd. So I do hope I enjoy your company for those episodes. And of course, as always, kia kaha for the climate. As you know, you're listening to Fresh FM, the top of the South Community Access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz.
This podcast was brought to you by Fresh FM, with assistance from New Zealand On Air. Other great local podcasts are available through our website, freshfm.co.nz.